This is a tape about choosing a mate. It was prepared by Dr. David A. Siemens, writer and pastor of Wilmore United Methodist Church, host church to Asbury College and Asbury Seminary in Wilmore, Kentucky. This tape is not meant to replace a counselor, to answer all your questions, or to solve your problems for you. It is intended as a supplement to counseling, an added plus which your counselor would like you to hear and discuss during some later counseling session. We know that this tape can be helpful to you, so listen now as Dr. Siemens talks to you about choosing a mate.
The American way of dating and courtship as it is structured at present can be a rather ruthless and risky business. There are a great many injustices in it, particularly for the woman, who has to walk a razor's edge between attractiveness and seduction, warm availability and patient waiting. It's not the only system in the world, and it may not be the best one either. But it's all we have just now, and so your job as a Christian is to try to make the best possible Christian decision within its framework. It won't do you any good to study some of the biblical examples, such as Isaac and Rebekah, because in those days persons did not choose mates. They were chosen for them. So you can't take these stories out of their ancient settings and expect any direct help on our subject. The best we can do is to try to extract from their examples and teachings of the Bible some Christian principles which will help you make right decisions in this regard. To begin with, let me say something which may shock you, since it's not what you usually hear on the subject. God does not choose your mate for you. In the final analysis, this must be your own personal decision and one for which you must assume responsibility. God will certainly guide you in making the right decision, but as the wedding ceremony puts it, for better or worse, the choice is yours. Perhaps the best place to begin would be by refreshing your minds as to how we make any Christian decision. There are five great avenues or ways by which God guides us. Now, any major decision should be based on general agreement on all or most of the five, and never on the basis of just one single avenue of guidance. Like a ship's pilot, we must try to line up not just one or two, but all of the five lights before we sail into the harbor. Here are the five. First, the Scriptures. The Bible comes first because it is God's written and spoken word to us. In it, God has shown us His will for us and how to find that will. This does not mean some isolated verse by itself. Many have been led astray because they place too much emphasis on a single verse and fail to balance this with the general principles from the whole of God's Word. Second, the inner voice. Sometimes we call these feelings or impressions. They are important, but they can also be very dangerous, and they must be tested carefully. Many of us go wrong and make sad decisions by following only an inner impression and not taking the time to check it out with the other avenues of guidance. Third, outer circumstances. God often matches our inner feelings, that's something very subjective, with outward circumstances, something more objective. He opens a door here or he closes one there. This is God's way of confirming our feelings with a concrete situation or circumstance. The fourth avenue of guidance is reason. Not merely our unaided human reason, but as E. Stanley Jones used to put it, our heightened moral intelligence. Don't shortchange your mind. It is God's chief communication system in your life. A calm, spirit-controlled consideration of all the factors involved is important, and no decision should ever be made without it. Never bypass the best common-sense reasoning. It is often God's way of showing you what choice to make. Fifth and last, other people. Our personal preferences need the corporate corrective of a trusted friend, a wise counselor, or a small group of which you may be a member. Now, under normal circumstances, this certainly includes your family. It could include your larger family, that is, your church, and the household of faith. Several times in the book of Acts, we read the phrase, quote, it seemed good to the Holy Spirit and to us. They checked out their individual ideas with the group. And that's a good habit for all of us, especially when we are making important decisions like this one. Now, the important thing is to remember that true Christian guidance is a cumulative matter. You need to wait upon the Lord until there is general agreement between all or most of these five voices. Guidance is often the forging of one link after another in a chain until the whole is complete and convinces us, and then we have peace about it. That peace comes from unhurried and careful balancing of the cumulative guidance from these great five ways God has of speaking to us. Now let's apply these ways of making general decisions to the particular decision which you are now considering, that is, the choosing of a life's partner. There's a great deal of misunderstanding here, so let's look at it very carefully. In addition to the five avenues of guidance we've been talking about, there are three great Christian principles which are involved in this specialized area of choice. These are the Christian principles for choosing a mate. First, spiritual unity. This comes directly out of specific teachings of the Bible and is also based on its fundamental idea that in marriage, the two shall become one. Now, at this place, God comes into the picture in a very real and definite way. 2 Corinthians 6:14 says, "Be not unequally yoked together with unbelievers." Or, as the more modern paraphrase puts it, "Don't be mismated with an unbeliever." This means, if you are a truly committed Christian, you are not free to choose a non-Christian mate. "Can two walk together unless they be agreed?" asks Amos, and gives a negative answer. Then how in the world could you live together in the most intimate of all human unions? You cannot, God says. Here, God makes a very definite choice for you, not for the specific person, but as to the kind of person you can choose. Your mate must be one with you spiritually. The first principle, spiritual unity. The second Christian principle for choosing a mate is vocational unity. Here again, God comes into the picture in a very definite way. What do you feel is God's calling for your life? What is His specific will for you in regard to a vocation? Can the circle of God's will for you and for your partner overlap? For example, are you called to be a missionary to, say, Zaire? But your partner feels she should be a teacher in the USA. Then you may be very fine people. You may like each other very much. But it is obvious that you are not God's will for one another. Sometimes one person may not have a particular call. He may have certain gifts and talents with a willingness to serve God through them. And in this case, the specifics may come through the call of a partner. In any case, there must be full and free agreement at this point, particularly when specialized forms of Christian service are involved. We all know lives that have been wrecked because young people have not been careful enough in regard to vocational agreement. It's like making two circles, each circle representing God's will for each individual life, and then seeing whether or not these two circles can overlap over each other and become one circle. That is, God's will for your life together as a team. Now, at this point, let me say something which may seem to contradict my original statement. In the first two areas, God very definitely comes into your decision. Although he does not choose your mate for you, nevertheless, he does prescribe the kind of person whom you are free to choose as your mate. It's like giving you a circle of freedom and saying, within that circle, you may choose anyone. Is there then only one person whom you can marry? One person whom God has chosen for you to marry? I personally do not think so. I believe there are several to whom you could be happily married, provided they fit into that prescribed circle of God's will. However, within our American way of courtship, it is highly unlikely that this could be possible. Now, let's not kid ourselves. The limiting circle of these two conditions, that is, spiritual unity and vocational unity, is a very serious matter, and this is where many get into serious trouble. Some come to me to counsel about it. They tell me that they feel that they love a certain person. They list all the fine qualities and how well they get along. Then they add, there's only one trouble. He or she is not a real Christian. Some tell me they're praying about it. We're waiting for God to tell us if the person is okay for us. Don't waste your time and God's time by praying about whether or not you can marry a non-Christian. Because, you see, God has already given us in his word a very definite opinion on this matter. And to ask him to tell you something which would deny that would be a travesty of your faith. God cannot deny his word, so don't ask him to do that. No, on these two points, spiritual unity, vocational unity, God has given you very clear guidance, specific instructions. You may not like it, you may refuse it, but you are not free to revise it or water it down. Let us suppose now that you and your friend are in spiritual oneness and in vocational agreement. If this is true, then we may presume he or she could be God's will for you. But there is still another important area involved in your choosing a mate, and this is the third Christian principle for that choice, namely, personality blending. This is your social, intellectual, emotional, and family compatibility. There are 1,001 different personality factors involved. Let's try to understand them by asking and answering some questions. These questions are listed on your How to Use This Tape sheet. Now, it is written for women, but a man could, of course, substitute she or her when it is appropriate and use the list. Here are the questions. Do you have the same general economic and social outlook on life? Does he have the qualities in him that you want to see in your children? Do you have real respect for him? Is this the kind of a person you want to look at across the breakfast table for the next 40 years? How do you get along? Do you quarrel too much of the time? Do your personalities blend well together? Can you communicate well? Can you really share in depth with one another? Do you accept him as he is? And does he accept you as you are? Or do you have an insatiable desire to change him in order to love him? Do you have a great number of things you like to do together? Do you have a feeling of pride when you compare your friend with anyone else you know? Do you suffer from a feeling of unrest when you are away from him? Even when you quarrel, do you still enjoy being together? You being who you are and your partner being who he is, can the person really satisfy your deepest emotional needs? Have you a strong desire to please him and are quite glad to give way on your own preferences? Do your friends and associates admire this person? Do they think it would be a good match for you? Do your parents think you are in love? You know they're very discerning about such things. Have you started planning, at least in your own mind, what kind of wedding and children and home you will have? Do you feel a strong physical attraction for the person? This is important. Nothing could be worse than a lifetime with someone who didn't really ring your chimes. And finally, what may seem strange, do you really want to marry this person? Some have been surprised when they took a hard look at this last question and found out that they really didn't want to marry the person, that something had pressured them into thinking they wanted to marry. So it's a good question to ask and to keep asking often. Do I really want to marry this person?
At this point, it will be good for you to stop the tape and to answer the questions one by one that Dr. Siemens has raised. They're printed on your tape guide sheet. Please do this before listening to the remainder of the tape.
Now, as you come up with honest answers to questions such as these, you will be discovering whether or not this person ought really to be your choice. For in this great area, in a very real sense, God Himself has put you on your own. This is your decision, and only you can make it. It must be made prayerfully, with a constant plea for the guidance of the Holy Spirit. But you must make the decision. God will not make it for you. And it is a weak and unchristian cop-out to ask Him to do it. Have you ever thought of it this way? Just how would God do it anyhow? Would He write in lightning in the sky, "Marry Harry"? Or would He hang it on the end of an apple tree in leaves or something? And it would read, "Don't marry Sherry"? No. God won't do it that way, and it is wrong to ask Him to. He has given you eyes and ears, emotions and preferences, and above all, a thinking mind which you are supposed to use. Now, in the first two principles, spiritual and vocational unity, God has very carefully chosen for you not the exact person, but the kind of person that He would allow you to choose. He has thus limited your freedom. He says to you, "This could be my will for you, but you do the choosing." You see, to ask God to do the choosing, in a way, would be to deny the very nature of marriage. For when you walk down to the altar on your wedding day, you are saying to the church and to the world, to yourself, to your friends, and to each other, "I have chosen you. This is my decision. I am willing to take the risk of this decision because you meet for me all the qualifications which God has prescribed for my partner: spiritual oneness, vocational unity. Yes, but more, for there are several who might possibly meet those divine qualifications. But I choose you because you also meet my own personal qualifications. You please me the most. Of all the persons I have met, I want you alone to be my partner. This I believe, and to this I commit myself. And because I believe this, I am willing to stand here and tell the world that I love you, and you alone, and I am willing to make that commitment to love you for the rest of my life, till death do us part." In choosing your mate, there are two great errors to avoid. One is the Hollywood error. You see, we have been sold a false bill of goods by our sensate culture, namely, that love is an overwhelming kind of a feeling that sweeps over you with such intensity it will simply overwhelm you into the decision to marry. This is simply not true. Some personalities work that way, but some don't. Some persons have feelings that sweep them into decisions. Others have to make the decision first, make their commitment, and then they experience the sweep of feelings. Don't wait for the Hollywood surge of love. It may be love. It could just be overactive glands. There is the Hollywood error. But the second is the heavenly error. This is waiting for God to make the decision for you. That too is wrong. If you are a Christian, the Spirit lives within you. You now understand how to seek God and find His guidance. You now have Christian principles for choosing your mate. So, prayerfully, carefully make your commitment. God will guide you all along the way. But in the final analysis, the decision is yours.
This concludes Side 1 of Dr. Seaman's presentation on choosing a mate. On your guide sheet, there are some questions concerning this presentation. Please take the time to write down your answer to these questions before turning over the tape and beginning Side 2.
Now let's see how we can help you apply, in a very practical way, principles we suggested on Side 1. Since I don't know exactly where you are in this whole process of courtship, it makes it a little difficult. However, I'm going to keep it as practical as possible so that it will be helpful whether you are just looking at it from a distance, you haven't even started to think about marriage, or whether you are seriously considering a specific person as a possible life's partner. First, let's go back and take a closer look at the principle of spiritual oneness. Be sure you have paper and pen in hand so that when I indicate, you can stop the tape and jot down your answers for further consideration and discussion. God's commands against being mismated with unbelievers apply to the dating process as well as to marriage itself. This is because of our American custom that after a certain age level, anyone you date must be considered at least a potential mate. It's not always possible to know beforehand about your partner's spiritual life, but very early in the game, say after the first two or three dates, it is your Christian obligation to find this out. So let's begin with a very practical question. How much do you really know about this person's spiritual life? If the answer is very little, then ask yourself, how can I find out? Stop the tape and write down your answer to each of the following questions. Now remember, it's easy to look through rose-colored glasses and evaluate someone on the basis of possibility instead of reality. So try to stick to known facts and not just to your dreams of hoped-for changes. Write down the answers to the following questions. Does your partner witness to conversion and new life in Christ? Does his or her life evidence growth in the fruits of the Spirit as they are listed in Galatians 5:22-23? Have you ever discussed your spiritual life, its struggles, its goals, with your partner? Have you ever prayed together? Do you agree on a church and on your basic standards for living, for making decisions about what is right and wrong, and for a Christian home?
At this time, let us interrupt Dr. Seamans and suggest that you stop the tape and write down your answer to the questions which he has just given. These questions are printed on your guide sheet. Please stop the tape and do this now.
Now, if you don't have as yet a particular partner in mind, write down a list of the moral and spiritual qualities you expect to have in a mate. Then go over the list and see which are the areas where you could make concessions and the areas where you could not. Now, among others, this list should include factors like denomination, beliefs, convictions, standards of morality, social and recreational life, the use of tobacco or alcohol, Christian lifestyle, and the handling of money. Stop the tape and do this now. Let me draw on my own experiences in the counseling room to share with you two life situations where this first principle, spiritual oneness, enabled persons to clarify the issues and make right choices. Mary had been dating a classmate at the university for the past 3 months. There was a strong mutual attraction between them, and in many ways, the young man met the qualifications she always had in mind for a husband. But in the course of their courtship, she discovered that he was not a Christian and showed no genuine interest in becoming one. She came seeking counsel. She knew from a biblical standpoint that she must break up with the young man. But she was deeply troubled at one point. He had often told Mary that she was the first Christian he had ever known at close range, and that she had cleared away many of the misconceptions he had concerning the Christian faith. Here was her main question to me. If I break up with him now, I'm afraid he will turn off any possible future interest in Christianity. I'm the only real witness in his life. Shouldn't I keep on dating him in order to continue witnessing to him? How would you have answered her question? On the basis of the biblical principle number one, spiritual unity, the answer to her query was no. You do not date a person in order to witness or to win him or her to Christ. After a certain age level, dating is a serious matter, and the longer Mary dated him, the more hope she was building up for a possible marriage. This was unfair on her part unless she really intended to marry him. As far as the witnessing was concerned, by her continued dating, she was disobeying the plain statement of God's word, and thus badly weakening her witness. All this proved true when she decided to break up with him. At first he was angry. She had to bear the brunt of an attack on her, quote, snobbish Christianity. But later on he thanked her for her action, because down deep he said he had really felt it could never work out with their contradictory spiritual outlook. Actually, it brought respect for her Christian stance and gained his admiration in the long run. Here is another situation. Bill was a young adult who came forward during one of our church services and made a commitment of his life to Christ. Within a few weeks, he sat before me in my office, wondering about his relationship to a girlfriend. They were fond of one another. Marriage was in the back of their minds. But Bill was now a committed Christian, and he didn't see how he could possibly marry someone who did not share his newfound relationship to Christ, and therefore would not have the same basic values for a Christian home as he had. After a lot of agony and tears, Bill broke up with the young lady. I watched his life become empty for the next year, and when he left our area, he was still unattached. He often came back to talk about it, to share and to pray over his doubts and temptation, and the temptation to resent God for causing this loneliness. Finally, a year or two passed, and one day I received an excited letter from Bill telling me about meeting a terrific Christian gal and of their courtship and of their intended marriage. Now, often when talking to him, I had almost apologized for being so seemingly cruel. This is the way Bill concluded his letter Pastor, please keep on being cruel. It saved me from the greatest mistake in my life, and it made it possible to find God's perfect will in my choice of a mate. You say, but wouldn't Bill or Mary have had the spiritual strength to pull their mates up to their level after they had married them? The great English preacher Charles Haddon Spurgeon had a way of answering that question. He would ask the person to get on top of his desk and stand there. Then, grasping that person's hand, he would ask him or her to pull him up to his level, up on top of the desk. Of course, even though the person might have been stronger, Spurgeon was always easily able to pull him or her down off the desk. This was his illustration. It always got through. You see, because of all the complex dynamics of the marriage relationship, it's always easier to be pulled down than to pull someone up. Now let's try to evaluate the second principle, that of vocational unity. Write out your answers to these questions. If you have someone definite in mind, have him or her do the same. First, do I have a specific vocation to which I believe God is calling me? Second, are there any unusual hardships which my partner would face because of my vocation? What qualities would he or she especially need for partnership with me? For example, a doctor's life consists of a lot of loneliness and interruptions. A minister has a goldfish bowl life, pressures on family to conform and the like. A salesman, he has to travel a lot, there's separation, the temptations that face this kind of life. You see, vocation includes a lot of other areas beside your job. Therefore, and this is number three, is my concept of our roles in marriage and home compatible with my partner's calling? Is it compatible with my partner's educational plans, with his or her ideas of a career? How do I feel about combining home and career? Now, a very excellent questionnaire to help you make this evaluation can be ordered from Family Life Publications, Box 427, Saluda, S-A-L-U-D-A, Saluda, North Carolina, zip code 28773. It is called the Marriage Role Expectation Inventory. The Marriage Role Expectation Inventory. And it evaluates your mutual ideas of homemaking, authority, social life, education, employment, and support. Stop the tape now and write out your answers to the questions we have asked. At this point, we will take an in-depth look at the third principle, that is the principle of personality blending. It may be hard for you to imagine, but it is possible for two very fine Christians to have the same spiritual outlook, the same vocational calling to wed, and end up with an unhappy marriage. In my 16 years on the mission field, I saw this happen several times between two missionaries. They were committed Christians, they were dedicated to the same task, but they never should have married. Their personalities simply did not fit together, and their marriages became a burden and a hindrance to their work rather than a blessing and a help. Now, in the light of our discussion in the first part of this tape, what would you do if someone of the opposite sex whom you know but have never seriously dated, say they would write you a note and say to you, "The Lord has told me that you are the one I am supposed to marry." How would you respond to this? Would you, A, pray about it and see how you feel? B, accept it as divine guidance, since the person said it had come from God? C, reject it because you had no feelings for him or her? Or D, would you communicate with that person and explain that you could not agree because God just didn't work that way in choosing mates for us? Obviously, D, the fourth answer, is the correct one. Now, I have gone to some extremes here to help you see the importance of taking a long, hard look at the matter of personality blending. No, quote-unquote, being in love or feeling it's God's will is just not enough, for those are very subjective matters. God has given you a mind which He expects you to use in being as objective as you possibly can. Now, if you are getting serious about someone whom you are now dating, and especially if you are nearing the engagement stage in your courtship, it would be very helpful if you would find someone in your area who could administer to both of you the Taylor-Johnson Temperament Analysis Test. The Taylor-Johnson Temperament Analysis Test. The TJTA test. This is a splendid psychological exam that will help reveal to you and your partner your various personality traits. It is put out by Psychological Publications, 5300 Hollywood Boulevard, Los Angeles, California, 90227. Now, only an approved person, a pastor or counselor, specially trained in evaluating the scores, can administer this test to you. 9 personality traits and their opposites are displayed on a profile. When you and your partner take it, the areas of agreement and potential conflict are revealed. It is a very helpful tool. Its use is described in considerable detail in Norman Wright's booklet, The Christian Faces, on page 24 through 53. Wright also describes various ways of working as an individual and as a couple to overcome areas of disharmony. Information regarding the TJTA test, as well as Wright's book, may be had from Christian Marriage Enrichment, 8000 East Girard Street, Denver, Colorado, 80231. Please remember this. Every inch you gain in working out the various areas for better personality blending before marriage will be worth a mile after marriage. For example, Stan and Becky were an ideal couple. They got along so well, they never seemed to quarrel. But just about the time they were engaged, they took the TJTA test. And they were shocked to find that while he scored high on dominant, and she scored high on submissive, she also scored very high on hostility. When they came to talk, he was sure there was some mistake. Listen as they talk to the counselor.
Oh, we just don't understand those test results. I mean about Becky having a lot of resentments and all.
Could it be that Becky hasn't been as happy about you making most of the decisions as she said she was? Let's hear what
Becky
said.
Well, she always said she was glad I was so strong and sure of myself. She said she really liked that in the guy.
Why don't we let Becky express herself? Becky, I'd like you to tell us how you really feel about all this. You know, I've found those tests are usually pretty accurate, and I'm wondering if maybe you've been hiding your feelings from Stan.
I don't want to... I mean, Stan's so smart. He always has such good reasons. I just figure he must be right, and so...
And so you've just gone along with him. You agree?
Yeah. I just don't like to hassle.
And when you did this, what kind of feelings were you having?
I don't like to say it, but... I guess if I'm going to be honest, I'd have to admit that I've really been doing a slow burn for these last few weeks.
With help, this couple began to communicate their true feelings, both negative and positive, and found ways to share in the decision-making process. Their marriage profited greatly from being postponed while they prayed and worked to achieve personality harmony in this, which was their chief area of conflict. They, like many others, were grateful to the TJTA test for its part in their marital happiness. Discovering whether or not your personalities can live together will depend largely on how well you learn to communicate with one another. Unfortunately, it is much easier to explore the other person's body than his or her personality. As someone has said, it's easier to sleep together than to talk together. Talking is much harder to learn. It is also important that you talk about the right things. In this way, you will come to understand not only the other person's personality, but also your own. You will see how you look at things, how you respond to issues, how you cope with situations, how you get along with people, how you respond to time, to schedules, money, authority, responsibility, family and in-laws, intimacy and sex, how you respond to conflict, differences and opposition, moods and emotions, change and correction. No one can define personality, but basically it is your lifestyle. It is your way of meeting life, of coping, of relating to persons and things. It includes everything that makes you to be you, and your partner to be what he or she is. It's easy to see why the whole area of personality blending deserves every possible effort. As you carefully and prayerfully follow these suggestions, you will discover useful tools for the future and find wisdom for making the right choice of a mate in the present. Now, when this side of the tape is finished, turn the tape back and make a list of all those factors that I have just mentioned. Write down an evaluation of your own traits in relation to each one of them. Try to give a reason why you are this way, if you know why. This will give you a kind of a personality autobiography of yourself. Be sure to have your partner do the same. Then compare notes with one another. Be sure you express how you truly feel about what your partner shares. Your response to that, even if it is a negative feeling, that feeling in itself is an important indicator of your personality. That's you. Maybe not what you ought to be or want to be, but what you really are. And that's what's going to come out after you're married and your mask slips off. Share it now and see if you can both accept it and live with it. Begin now trying to work out the main area of differences. This will again show you one of the most important factors of personality blending, how you resolve your differences.
This is the end of Dr. Seaman's presentation, but he has suggested some things that might help you in your selection of a mate. You will notice that we have listed on the guide sheet the speaker's instructions concerning several factors in selecting a mate. How you look at things, how you respond to issues, how you cope with situations, etc. Please follow Dr. Seaman's instructions as you go through this list. This concludes Side 2 of the tape. Don't forget to return the tape to your counselor and to take along any notes that you have taken or growth activities that you have completed while listening to this tape. The examples on this tape are either fictitious or used with the permission of the people involved. Any resemblance to people that you might know is purely a coincidence.